down to the left side. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters above and down like a rebel fish. Journalist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom with all that getting, getting an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. It's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening media. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things put in the marketplace all the time. Different African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:06 here in the city of Philadelphia. And tonight we have a special guest joining us, author, activist, and president and CEO of the Taifa Group, LLC. Attorney Nakishi Taifa is with us this evening. Her book, Black Lawyer, Black Power, Black Lawyer, My Audacious Quest for Justice, will be the topic of conversation this evening while she's with us. And you can always get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies, everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:11 here in the city of Philadelphia on this Sunday evening. And before I get started with the program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum at 7th and Arch Street in Philadelphia. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine now. You know, the Sister Taifa, I never really met her personally, but been exposed to her. And one thing I want to start off saying before she even, bless us with her experience in developing her book and sharing her experience, is this is a woman that's bubbling. Bubbling, I know, volcanic with energy. I'll just say that.
Oh, boy, Richard, I'm telling you. Well, listen, it's good to be in conversation with author, activist, president, and CEO of the Taifa Group, LLC, attorney Nakishi Taifa is with us in the book, Black Power, Black Lawyer, My Audacious Quest for Justice. It's going to be the topic of conversation while she's here this evening. Attorney Taifa, are you with us?
I am with you, my brothers, but I must say something if I can.
Go ahead.
I appreciate what Brother Richard said, but you know, this is Sunday and Sunday night, and you would not believe this is the tail end of, oh my God, I was in London yesterday. I was in Yale Law School yesterday. I was with the Pan-African Federation yesterday. Today, I did a major presentation for a spiritual service. I did it. I mean, I just, woo! So if I'm not as bubbly and spontaneous with energy as I usually am, please forgive me.
Oh, because so you're going to be amongst us humans now. you're just going to be operating at the volume of the frequency of us humans now. I got it. I got you. I'll accept that.
It's all good. So how y'all doing?
Oh, everything is good. Attorney Taifa, listen, we're going to get right into it because I know that your time might be limited tonight, but if possible.
Yeah, I got two more meetings tonight, plus I got to catch Lovecraft Country. So
check you out.
Oh, okay.
Hey.
Attorney Taifa,
okay,
listen, the book was released maybe a little bit less or more than a month ago. Was it
less than a month.
Was it your plans to release it now in the midst of all of this pandemic, or was it kind of scheduled to be released and you just went ahead with the release of the book?
Actually, it was scheduled to be released 2 weeks after the election. Okay, this was long before COVID.
Okay.
But once COVID, because I thought everyone was going to be on vacation in July and August, September, you know, Congress just comes back, folks are just starting back to school and all like that. October was just too close to the election. You didn't want to do it the week of the election, so it's going to be a week after. But once COVID hit and, you know, March was underway, did a little reevaluation. I said, okay, now folks are quote unquote quarantined, so there's not going to be a whole lot of vacations going around. We really don't know what the situation going to be with the election. Hello? Okay. So, you know, I decided, I said, let this come out in September. And so I made my launch date. It was like September 22nd. And I decided to just roll with the punches. Of course, I thought I was going to be having a book tour and going around to different cities and all like that. But, you know, it is what it is. So everything is virtual. But I was able, again, to do a big book thing in the UK yesterday, while at the same time being on two sides of the coast of the United States. So, you know, I'm rolling with the punches.
Okay.
And doing it well.
Thank you.
Bridget?
You know, Elliot gave me the opportunity to speak with you first, but I wanted to, I want to make sure I say to you, because your experience and what I take is in the book is chronicling a moment in our history that we need to honor you and people like you, and in relationship to not just being about sovereign thinking, but being about actualizing Black power. I think that we need to give you and all of those before you and who are with you now, you know, you're due for doing that. And I want to do that and by saying Ashe. But the question came to my mind, Sister Taifa. You know, besides becoming, when did you say, this is my life work? If you don't mind me asking. At what point did that happen?
I can pinpoint the moment. you know, I'm coming up during time when Black studies are coming into the classrooms. We're talking about in the late 60s, and I'm in my junior high school, eighth grade classroom, Black studies classroom, and there's this poster tacked on the bulletin board of a Black man with a Black beret on his head, with a spear in one hand and a rifle in the other hand, sitting in a Grand Slam wicker chair. And all the teenage girls in my class were giggling about how fine this dude was, you know. And I was asking the teacher, well, what is he doing in prison? And why is the head of the Black Panther Party being represented by a white lawyer? Now, Chu was a progressive lawyer, a radical lawyer, but the question that kept gnawing at my soul was, where are the black lawyers to represent the black people? So from that moment, I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. Not that I knew any lawyers, I didn't. Not that I know anything about what a lawyer was, really I didn't. All I know is that my daddy told me once that, he said, Needy, if you are really good with numbers, you know, you could be a doctor. But if you're really good with words, you could be a teacher or a lawyer. So I ended up being both a teacher and a lawyer, far, far from a doctor, because I sure enough wasn't good with numbers at all. So it really was that. But harkening back a little bit earlier, if I may, all of the things kind of crescendoed together, because I'm like a preteen, like maybe around 11, 12, sitting on the floor in my family's den library, and I'm flipping through this book called The Pictorial History of the Negro in America by Howard Metcalf and Langston Hughes. And I'm flipping to this page where it's talking about this little 14-year-old boy from Chicago who had gone to visit his relatives down south and was found at the bottom of Mississippi Tallahatchie River. And the reason why it really caught my attention, because this happened in August, I think it was, 1955, at a time when I was 5 months old. And I'm thinking, excuse me, this stuff is happening in my lifetime? I'm thinking that all of this discrimination and all this happened way back in slavery time, which to my young mind was like millions of years ago. I had no concept of time. So then all of that, Fannie Lou Hamer being beaten torturously for trying to register to vote, the poor little black girls bombed in, you know, Sunday school. All this happened when I'm in first, second, and third grade. So when I get to eighth grade and the picture of Huey Newton up there, it just kind of all came together. And I knew that I wanted to be someone who would help to make a difference, someone who could help to change things. And I wanted to be a black lawyer that would do those things. Not that I did any of it, but that was the.
You did your due. And I want everybody to know, they'll definitely find out if they acquired a book.
The book,
that you did. And if I may push that a little further in my mind, and hopefully it resonates. So here now, you knew you wanted to be a lawyer, but as you started to become mentored by particular lawyers in the Black Power movement, in looking for Black sovereignty, and all the things that were going on around that time, how did that affect you? Or did you become more anchored in your personality, said, oh, this is, I'm about this. Yes. Not, I'm just not a lawyer. I'm a warrior's lawyer in this here war for power.
Yeah. So I was an activist long, 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 long before I actually became a lawyer. Because, like I said, I was like conscious, even in, you know, junior high school. I'm 16 years old, going in a black bookstore and getting an African name book and picking an African name for myself. That's why I don't pronounce my name correctly, because I was 16. I didn't know N-K-E-C-H-I was supposed to be N-K-C-H-I. I looked at it, it looked like it said N-K-C-H-I. I'm 16, so I said, okay, my name is Natiti, right? And it wasn't until much, much later after I went to college that I saw that I found out I was pronouncing my name incorrectly. But, you know, by then, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, our tongues have been colonized. And yes. We're a new branch of the African family on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. I believe in self-determination. So, you know, I kept the pronunciation rather than the way it would have been pronounced if I were in Igbo in Nigeria, which is where the name came from. But, you know, I'm in high school, and in high school, I'm doodling and stuff, and I'm visioning a society. I'm in high school, like 1970. I'm visioning a society that is separated in half. And the black people are living in one half, and the white people are living in another half. And the black people's half is full of freedom and justice and equality, and the white people's half is oppression and war, you know, Vietnam War and death and all like that. And so this was in high school. So when I get to college, and I'm sitting in Douglas Hall at Howard University, And I hear an outside speaker talking about a black nation and talking about the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which recognized the freedom of black people. And then 2.5 years later, the 14th Amendment saying that you are citizens. And there's this span of almost 3 years where we are so-called free, but we're not citizens. And what the speaker is saying is the 13th Amendment freed you, but the 14th Amendment could not have made you a citizen because you had to have been asked. International law says that any free people with rights of self-determination have to be asked what they want their political future, their sovereignty, their destiny to be, and we were never asked. And as history has borne, the so-called 14th Amendment granting us a citizenship, and never, ever, ever was meant to be a real a citizenship. It wasn't until 100 years later, with the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and we're still fighting for the right to vote. So I was already trying for nationhood and self-determination and pride and culture and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't like a doctrine that was forced into my head. I kind of came to it organically, and then I found structures that helped to buttress that in my mind.
Great.
And I tell about all that in my book.
And one thing that came to me as we were thinking about this interview, you know, to ask, and being this audacious journey that you develop in your book and you've lived out in your life was, okay, usually we hear, especially during the Black Power period, about how women are treated. And it raised the question in my mind, you know, as lessons that women who are coming online now in this fight for freedom and justice and liberation. How did you manage your, as a woman in this activism, manage your life, you know, as your personal life and your family life? Is there examples that you can give other women who are coming through this now and that is maybe outlining your book by your experience of how they have to or dealing with some of the issues that you dealt with?
So, my brother, I really don't mean to disappoint, okay? Because my experiences were not like what maybe people who consider themselves feminist experiences might be or might have been. I always was a very outspoken person. I always was a person who knew what I was talking about. I always was a kind of like a take charge type of person. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of folks out there doing the work back then in those days. I didn't experience those issues. I didn't really personally have a problem with leadership. I was in leadership. I mean, whether I wanted to be or not, I was the expert person. I'm not talking about, I'm in my early 20s now, you know, but I was treated with respect. I will say this. You know, I'm noticing I'm sitting up in these meetings. You know, y'all know those were in the days we had meetings that lasted until midnight and all like that. Nothing, but, you know, we were in the struggle and, you know, we were, you know, the revolution and all like that. And I'm noticing I'm in these meetings with all these men. And I said, we are the women. You know, they're women, always like home and taking care of the home and doing whatever the status quo said, women. And I'm up here. I'm saying, wait a minute, what's wrong with this picture, you know? Maybe I should be out there having a good time and all like that. But my mind was really focused on the struggle. You know what I'm saying? And so, I mean, you know, I had those same things that always happens with everybody in terms of Me Too and this and that and the other. But, you know, it's like, I mean, part of that was just part of life. I mean, I always was a race person, a race woman, okay? There never really was a separation in my mind with brothers and brothers and sisters. And I mean, I know that there were issues out there and all like that, but I knew it was in leadership. So I, you know, people respected me. At least I think, seem to think that they did, you know? It's not like it was all politics and struggle. I mean, I had my issues. I've been married 3 times, you know? My book isn't all politics and struggle. And, you know, as I say, I talk about my, relationships that, might or might not have worked. I talk about my big fat new African wedding and divorce. I talk about sex lies and videotape for husband from the class. So, I mean, I'm a real person, a real human being as well. It's not like I'm somebody up on the pinnacle or icon or something like that. No. I'm a down to, you know, life sister who goes through things that other people go through. But in terms of this black man, black woman scenario, honestly, my personal, that just is not my personal story. And I can't make it up to say that it is, because it isn't. But I always seem to get that question. So, again, sorry to disappoint, but there's many sisters you can turn to who will have juicy stories that they can, you know, lay at your feet.
I just, you know, as I turn it back over to Elia, I think that that's important to be down to earth and recognize that this struggle, you know, as women or as men, you know, that, you know, being in this is not no easy thing as far as navigating our lives. And I'll just, you know, say, because in my experience in the organizations that we had in here in Philly, you know, personally, women led me. I mean, as advisors, when you talk about leadership, as advisors, what to do, what not to do, how, like, you got to sharpen up on this skill or that skill. So I think that, you know, and we have to be able to deal with that. As you say, we're constantly evolving in order to do this work. But what you really pointed out that I want to, you know, make clear for all of us is that you were centered on the work, the struggle, which it makes it easier, even with its difficulty. And I appreciate to be able to, you know, share, ask questions and share thoughts with you.
We're in conversation with author and activist and an attorney, Nakeishi Taifa. The book, Black Power, Black Lawyer, My Audacious Quest for Justice, is a topic of conversation, and you can get involved always in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Attorney Taifa, in the time that we have with you, I'm going to jump around to different things. I know Richard wants to get back and ask a couple more things. But let me, because right now, in fact, a couple of days earlier, it was the 25th anniversary of the Million Man March. And in 1995, you were teaching at Howard University at the time, and you served as the coordinator and trainer for the Legal Observer Committee, the legal observers that went to the march or that were participated in the march. Yeah. Talk about how that came about. Was it maybe student activists that approached you, whether it was Minister Farrakhan that talked to you? How did you get involved to organize around the march?
All right, so I'm part of the community, part of the struggle. I really don't remember exactly, but I was a lawyer, and I was at Howard. I had access as a student because some kind of way, you know, I organized a number of different training sessions at the law school. And let me tell you this, my brother, just about all of the students that volunteered to come to the Legal Observer Million Man March training sessions were the sisters. The sisters, like my training sessions were made up almost primarily of black women. You know why? Of course we know why. Just wanted some kind of way, shape, form, or fashion to be down there on that mall with all them fine black brothers, you know, but to be there officially and doing official legal work, oh, man, they just loved it. And, you know, let me just, there weren't any incidents. There might have been one, and it might have been something minor. But, I mean, with 2 million people out there, to have no, you know, incidents, I mean, you know, the sisters were bad. It wasn't just sisters. It was brothers that served as legal observers as well. But it was just a perfect fit. Again, I never divorced myself from a community work. In fact, the work that I did at Howard Law School at the time, I was the director of what was called the Equal Justice Program, and part of our mission, the mission that I developed, was to support, you know, many of the demonstrations, the socially conscious, justice-oriented demonstrations that were going on in Washington in the nation's capital. So that was a very thrilling time, and I know we just had the 25th anniversary of the Million Man March, and I also attended the Million Women March, you know, a couple of years later in Philly.
Mm-hmm.
I had my little baby girl with me, you know, at that time. You know, but one of the things that really got me, though, about the Million Man March and other stuff that was going on at the time, that was during the time of the crime bill and all that, and Clinton was president, and it just still kind of galls me that during that time there really was no difference between the Democrats and Republicans when it came to criminal justice issues. It really wasn't. We have come a long way since that, okay, since the past 25 years, and I'd like to think that I had something just a little bit to do with that, where we are now.
I hope before you leave that we can kind of jump back, because some of the questions that I have is in relation to what you're just talking about, because some of your work focuses in on some of those things that's key in that crime bill. 1997, you served as a prosecutor and delivered the opening statements in the International Tribunal for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That was in Philly. That was in Philly. Yeah.
Now talk about that. How did who was present? How did that work? Because I know that those actions that were taken by you and others kind of helped garner international support for Brother Mumia. So how give the listening audience some background on that. And also, okay, I want you to express to the audience, because you've seen the court transcripts of Mumia's trial. What kind of really grates me is other blacks in leadership, black politicians, or even black lawyers. Some of them are familiar with the trial, especially here in Philadelphia. Some of them have read the transcripts. And for them not to stand up and really say that Mumia didn't get a fair trial during that period is disingenuous at best, and I'll just leave it like that. But talk about your participation in that, and by reading the transcripts, tell the listening audience some of the things that you observed during that whole scenario.
Okay, so this was in 1997, the end of 1997. In fact, it was a innovative, it was a historic, it was a mock proceeding. So it wasn't an actual trial; it was a mock proceeding. It was entitled The People's International Tribunal Investigating the Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And it was, in fact, an international tribunal. And I don't remember the names of all the illustrious people that are part of it, but there was an international panel of jurists and political leaders and labor and community activists and cultural figures and others concerned with social justice. And I almost remember, I think Geronimo Adjaye recently got out of prison, and he was there. Sophia Elijah was there. Chokwe Lumumba was there. There was quite a number of people, in addition to international people as well. And the indictment, again, this was our mock indictment. It charged the governor and several Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices, the state attorney general, Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, the mayor, fraternal order of police, DAs, FBI, DOJ, the trial judge. The indictment charged all of them with conspiracy to silence Mumia using false charges, using a fraudulent trial, brutal imprisonment, and, you know, imposing the death penalty in an attempt to silence him forever. And at the time of the mock trial, there were several new witnesses that had come forward that were not allowed to get the actual case, you know, opened up. And there were witnesses who recanted earlier a testimony, and there were witnesses who, you know, showed how they were, you know, abused by the prosecution, and the whole case was a hot mess. I just can't say it any other kind of way, shape, form, or fashion. Thankfully, the death penalty is no longer over. Mumia's here, but he should have long ago been, you know, released. The standard in a criminal case is beyond a reasonable doubt. There's so many places where you can point within that trial, within the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, that there was doubt here, doubt there, doubt here, that, you know, that there's no reason why he should still be in prison. But again, the tribunal, again, was an effort to bring international attention to the case of Mumia, just like Mamie Till Mobley strove to do in 1955 when she demanded an open casket for her son, Emmett Till, so that the world could see what racism and oppression and depravity and, you know, and all like that did to her only son.
In 2007, you also were involved, and as a prosecutor also, in the tribunal for centering around Hurricane Katrina that happened in 2005, in August of 2005. Tell our listening audience a little bit about that, because, you know, even now, black folks that live in New Orleans have not recovered from Katrina. In fact, a lot of black folks that were displaced during that whole tragedy never returned. Talk about some of the things implicating the government and what happened there, their response, the racism. Just give our listening audience a little synopsis of that also.
So actually, 10 years after the Mumbai Abu-Jamal International Tribunal, I was asked to play a similar role in it was a tribunal called the International Katrina Tribunal in New Orleans, and I again served as a prosecutor. The only time I ever was in a prosecutor when I was prosecuting the U.S. government and FBI and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, there were hearings that were held earlier. There were testimonies from survivors that were earlier. There were testimonies that happened at this particular time, at this, and they were all very consistent. And I talk about a lot of that, some of that in my book in the segment on that People's Tribunal. But, you know, some of the things that some of the brothers and sisters were saying was that we were treated as if we were criminals when all we wanted was to survive. You know, witnesses say that Katrina was a man-made disaster orchestrated by the government. You know, the witnesses were saying they were shooting as we ran across the bridge trying to get to dry land, screaming, "You niggers and monkeys are not going to get across that bridge." But we knew that we had to run anyway, because if we didn't, and we had to turn around and go back to those rising waters, we would die. I mean, that was the desperation that witnesses came forward. The thing that kept being repeated over and over and over again was, they left us here to die. So one of the things I sought to do as part of the prosecutorial opening statement was to show how these violations that were happening in this country that we live in and in Louisiana were the violations were based upon relevant international law, whether it was provisions within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or the American Convention on Human Rights, the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination, the Convention Against Genocide, you know, all of these international conventions, Convention Against Torture, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, again, trying to bring an international lens to what is happening domestically. And that's one thing this country doesn't really like to happen.
Yes.
Okay. And so, Brother Chokwe Lumumba, who was living at the time, this is before he became mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, was very much involved with this. He was my legal mentor, I might say. Brother Mario Bubakari Obadeli was my legal mentor also, even though he wasn't even a lawyer. He was a political scientist. But, you know, these are the people, Queen Mother Audley Moore, you know, the people and the forces that, you know, helped to shape me, to put me in a position where I could carry out the things that I learned from them.
You know, you mentioned Chokwe Lumumba, who's an ancestor now. You've contributed to at least three books that I see here, and I want you to kind of reflect back on those. Black Reparations, American Slavery and Its Vestiges. Reparations, Yes, the Legal and Political Reasons Why Blacks Should Be Paid for the Enslavement of Our Ancestors, and the Decolonization, USA. I think two of those books you contributed with Chokwe Lumumba on. But talk about talk about three of those titles, because you were involved with folks in the struggle and organizations in the struggle long before it became, I'll use the term popular here over the past couple of years by other folks that have jumped on board. But talk about some of your early struggles in the several of the historic organizations that have been fighting reparations and those books, the ideal behind writing those books and contributing to those books.
So, yeah, you're right. We're talking about the catalyst for a lot of stuff that you see going on happening today. You know, we were part of the theoretical underpinnings of what I call, what is called in the movement, New African Political Science. Mm-hmm. I sat at Brother Mario Badelli's feet learning these precepts. I was mentored by Brother Chokwe Lumumba learning these precepts, and at a very early age. So it's in 1987, I think it is, that there was a conference at the National Conference of Black Lawyers called at Harvard, actually. And the issue, the question at the conference was whether we needed a constitutional amendment in order to effectuate reparations or something along those lines. And my brother Imari Obadeli, Brother Chokwe Lumumba, and myself were invited by National Conference of Black Lawyers, attorney Adjoa Ayotoro, to be exact, to present papers on that topic. And the three of us agreed unequivocally that we didn't need no constitutional amendment. We already had our rights of self-determination that was part and parcel of international law. All that was needed was to put that into effect. And so the papers we each wrote for that conference, we put together into a booklet, and this is 1987, called Reparations Yet. Okay, and I use the, I don't know why I forget about this. I'm looking up on Amazon, and they're selling that for who knows how many hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. I'm the last surviving author. I plan to put that book back out because I think that people need to have this information because it's done from an independence frame and from a New African frame of reference. That conference and that book was really the catalyst behind the formation of NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Black Reparations in America. Brother Imari issued the call for all the different groups that were out there that were talking about reparations, and these are all our folks, the revolutionary organizations, the groups on the left, on the side, doing no mainstream organizations talking about this at that time. Other than, I will say, I mean, most folks wouldn't consider them mainstream, but the National Conference of Black Lawyers, of which I was a member of, was very, very open to it. So we had this convening in Washington in September of 1987, and then COBRA, National Coalition of Black Reparations in America, was born. But I do want to say this, in honor of the New African Independence Movement, because our philosophy, and I'm saying our because that's the movement I grew up in, that's the Black Power underpinning of which, formed the basis for a lot of my beliefs. Our position was that reparations usually happens at the end of a war. And the two parties come to the negotiating table. The two parties meaning the two entities, government to government or whatever. And, they decide just what the damages of that is going to be. What the New African Independence Movement did, however, was put aside our independence politics for the greater good so that the reparations issue could be thrust more firmly into the mainstream, who did not necessarily believe in a Black nation in the South, five states in the South, that there's a president of that nation, Mario Badelli, and there's a minister of justice, Nkechi Taiwo, or Chokwe Limu. The mainstream society, they weren't in for all that. So what we did was we decided to work closely with John Conyers and craft a reparations bill, which ended up being called H.R. 40, that paralleled the recent success of the Japanese American reparations bill, which had just passed 1988, which granted $20,000 each Japanese American detention camp survivor a trust fund to be used to educate Americans about the sufferings of the Japanese American, a formal apology from the U.S. government, and get this, a pardon for all those who resisted detention camp internment. So they started that movement with a study bill. So that's what we went along with John Conyers with. Okay, we'll start with a study bill to study all of these issues from enslavement to black codes to the penal system to sharecropping and Homestead Act and lynchings and Jim Crow apartheid and redlining all the way down to mass incarceration. We'll study all of that, and then we'll come up with proposals and recommendations. But my brothers, that was 31 years ago. And the bill had not moved until really last year, when you have 2020 candidates coming out of the woodwork,
yes,
talking about if the bill passes that they would sign it. So now we have had the bill most precisely as a result of NCOBRA and a brother named Cam Howard. NCOBRA and a group called NARC, National African American Reparations Commission, and brother Cam moving the bill from just a study bill to actually a remedy bill. We don't need another 30 years to study the issue. We need to go on and have it remedied. We need to have those proposals right now. So there's been a lot of books written since our 1987 reparations, yes. I mean, scholars of the yin-yang, economists, psychiatrists, psychologists, statisticians, religious leaders, you know, everybody, there's loads of a paper out there on the issue now, going on down to Ta-Nehisi Coates, who really swept it into the mainstream.
If I may,
go ahead, Richard.
You know, I'm following up on that, and I appreciate what you did, because it centers. But the thing that struck out to me that is really important for me, those of us who are looking at really trying to move in some generation to be a sovereign people, and recognizing that this is not just some, you know, slogan for the moment or in a generation, this is a generational thing. The important thing that you said is that when the Republic of New Africa, when decided to say, looking out for the greater good for all Black people, we're not going to push it from an independent perspective. Because what's going on now, and that's what I wanted to get your view on, how do you, and you laid out all, you know, you brought us up to all the people that bring it, how do you view the reparations bill and climate right now from your historical perspective?
Well, we've come farther than we've ever come. I mean, reparations is definitely a household word now, whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, or whether you're on the internet viewing a lot of stuff, or, you know, whether you're in the halls of Congress debating it. I mean, it's definitely an issue whose time has come. When you have organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights Watch and Center for American Progress right on board with reparations, when you have corporations like Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, mm-hmm, right on par with reparations, you know, when you have academic institutions like Georgetown beginning to open up their casket to the role that the enslavement era that they directly participated in, and other universities doing the same, when you have religious institutions doing this, when you have corporations and industries, when we have state governments now and city councils, okay, all over the country now, talking about passing bills to look at their own culpability in terms of not just the enslavement era. We're talking about not just enslavement, but post-slavery all the way down to today. Hey, it is a new day. So I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because it's not a fringe issue anymore. Okay, I think it might be time now, though, for the independence movement to get back out with its thrust in front, because, you know, it's out there in the mainstream now. Now it's the time for the various discussions and debates and all like that to go on and be had. But the principal thing about it is, this is not just a United States thing. And issue of reparations, reparatory justice, is a global issue, because white supremacy, white fascism, white terrorism was and is a worldwide phenomenon. So you have people in the Caribbean with CARICOM, you know, demanding reparations. You have people in Europe demanding reparations. You have people in you know, other parts of the world. You know, everybody's talking about, you know, it's time, you know, for justice, for reparatory justice. This is the, we're in the second half of the international decade of people of African descent. You know, we need to seize the time.
And I definitely am glad that you brought up that. And I do hear hear it, the voice in this generation, the generation that is in front of us. They are the discussion about a sovereign space is, you know, the analysis that was made is coming back to fore. And, you know, my last thought, you know, to get your point of view on. And again, for everybody, Sister Taifa's book is like really critical to be able to understand that period, her and the people who shaped the value of what it is to be a sovereign thinking. And I try to push that all the time. You know, the thing that came to me was, again, you were around in the period in communication with a lot of folks around the COINTELPRO, when the COINTEL was kind of now visible to everybody. How do you compare that to, you know, in your mind, or if there's a comparison to the Black identity extremist thrust that's being put out there in the public space now? Do you see them as a comparative or different?
It's just another name. You know, COINTELPRO morphed into quote unquote Black identity extremists. And one of the things I found as I've been speaking, I don't want to make assumptions that everybody knows what we're talking about. A lot of times I talk and then I realize people don't know what the hell I'm talking about. They don't know what these terms are. So for those who might be millennials or newer to the struggle, COINTELPRO was the once secret and very quite illegal program of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the activities of Black nationalist organizations and groupings and their leadership, their membership, their supporters, and something else. I'm going from memory. But, you know, there was COINTELPRO against a lot of movements, but specifically against the Black nationalist movement. And they used a number of different tactics to attempt to disrupt and destroy. Those were the FBI's own words. The COINTELPRO was investigated in the 70s by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. It's called the Church Committee. And that Senate body characterized the COINTELPRO as a war. And there are people who are still sitting in prison today, yes, as a result of that war. Sundiata Okoli is still sitting in prison today, the co-defendant of Assata Shakur, as a result of that war. Brother Mutulu Shakur is still sitting in prison today as a result of that COINTELPRO war. Brother Veronica Bowers is still sitting in prison today. Now, true, a number of people have been released, but how can you really call that a victory? Jaleel Musakim, Anthony Bottom, was just released last week, suffering from COVID, has been in prison over 40 years.
Yes.
How are we going to call that a victory? Geronimo Jijaga was in prison 27 years, the same amount of time that Nelson Mandela was in prison. And as a result of health issues and all like that, not too long afterwards, he passed. How are you going to call that a victory, particularly since the FBI even knew that he was not guilty? They knew because COINTELPRO had tapped the phone and knew he was at a meeting of the Black Panther Party at the time in which a white tennis player was being murdered in California. So, I mean, I'm just saying it's morphed into Black identity. Now, they have this new program, Black Identity Extremists. What they should be looking at, these white they should be looking at, people were talking about kidnapping a governor of a state. That's
two
what
governors.
They should be looking at. And if they're talking about kidnapping a white woman governor of the state, what do you think these white terrorists have in store for us? Yet you have the chief executive of this country giving a wink and a nod to these people and telling them to stand by. I mean, you know, COINTELPRO has just changed names, that's all.
Yes, and again, you know, it's because of the sacrifice those men and women made And I wanted just to tie, you know, in closing for me, that they made and still had the values to say, and you enunciated that, well, we're looking at reparations, right? Because you framed it, it is usually after a war is won that you have, but looking at reparations, say, well, look, because we know we're about the liberation of African, you know, new African people. So we're going to back off so that the ideal can grow in a space that it wouldn't grow if we just pushed it from our vantage point. I want to be able to, you know, once again, you know, really commend you for your work and your contribution. And it ain't the pinnacle, but the legacy that's being left behind is the book that you are now going around and letting us experience the experience that you had with, and that's Black Power, Black Law.
So I just want to say, and I know we may come to a close, I just want to say also, I know I'm sounding real militant and revolutionary and all like that, but it really is a real human story. You know, it is the story of a little dark-skinned girl growing up in D.C., okay, and just being exposed to things and just drinking it all in, the good and the bad, you know, the ugly and the beautiful, okay, and, you know, deciding to become a lawyer and continuing the things that I learned as part of the a struggle into the legal, arena. It talks about spirituality as well and how spirituality helped to me to give birth to a beautiful miracle birth baby. I talk about personal issues that are, you know, very personal. I'm not even going to talk right now about that. Your folks can get the book and read it. But there are real issues that real people are confronted with. I did a presentation today. It was a major presentation. And I was all, as much as I speak and all like that, I was just kind of real nervous. And I just got lost and I just was fumbling and all. But then, you know, I got back on track and I was big, bad, Bo Jason Nikisi. But at the end, the sister said, I'm glad that you stumbled because it let her know that she too had something to offer, that she could do these things too. It's not that we're not perfect people up here, y'all. And even the people that I talk about, Brother Imari, that I hold up with such esteem, and Brother Chokwe, folks weren't perfect. But what we did do was did not allow ourselves to become succumbed by the governmental machinations under COINTELPRO to just tear the whole movement apart. There were some trying times, I'm telling you. But folks decided overtly to take the higher ground, okay? To take the higher ground, okay? And I'm just grateful, I'm just grateful that they did. And that was a lesson to me as well. You know, as we face and confront things that are happening every day today as well, we need to take the higher ground.
I want to thank you for being with us this evening, Attorney Taifa, and the contribution to our struggle here, and the struggle continues. Folks, get the book. You can, in fact, I'll let you tell the folks where they can get the book, Attorney
yes.
Taifa.
Thank you. Yes. You can get the book. Please first ask for it at any of your Black or independent bookstores, please. I have on my website a list of over 100 Black bookstores, www.blackpowerblacklawyer.com. You can order the book through the website. There are links to different places you can order it. You can also, of course, order it right on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, IndieBound. You know, you can order it there or, again, I recommend people ask for it at your Black or independent bookstore. But get the book. This wasn't financed by any big publishing company or house or anything along those lines. Ain't no money was poured into this. And, you know, I'm looking at things and I see folk, Black Lives Matter folk, you know, they got books are coming out the yin yang and supported by big corporations.
They didn't give you any of that money? They didn't give you any of that money?
No.
Hey, they got a TV show coming on.
I'm just an outlier, but I'm an authentic outlier.
Okay.
I'm very authentic. I have a lot of humor in here as well, but I drop a lot of seeds.
Good. All right. Thank you, my brother. I'm going to keep the number in the Rolodex because we always need some type of legal advice and legal opinion on things that's happening in our struggle here. So thanks for being with us, Attorney Taiva.
Okay. What? Peace and blessings. Free to land.
Talk to you soon. Okay. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll transition into open forum, and you can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. Abibitumi, Black Power, Abibitumi, the only word you need to know to join your global Kometz U Black family, to join your interconnected Kometz U Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
That this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. The brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us? or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda. Thank you.
We have a message to the black man, because the black man today is a man who has been made now almost into a laughing stock. Nobody takes the black man serious. We are just used to be somebody's tool. We are the sportsmen. We're the singers and the dancers. And we're also labeled as the pimps and the criminals and the drug dealers and the killers and the vagabonds of society. We're the bogeymen of British society and other Western systems. And we want to dispel that lie and destroy those myths and put the black man back on the map where we belong. Who is the black man? The black man is the original man. If it wasn't for the black man, no other men could be on this planet. We are the fathers of humanity. We gave birth to all of you.
We are the watchmen on the wall. You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchmen for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is, the people vote, but they don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend?
You can't do nothing for me. See, that's what we gotta be careful of. We gotta be careful of who we bow down to. But see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us. Yeah.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I want to thank our guest this evening that spent a little time with us, author and activist and president and CEO of the Taifa Group, LLC, attorney Nakishi Taifa, the book, Black Power, Black Lawyer, My Audacious Quest for Justice. Is available. You can go to her website. I'll make sure I put it up on the Time for Awakening website, but you can Google her name, and you can go to the website, and you can purchase the book from there or see a list of black bookstores in your area that you can purchase the book from. Just in case you want to write it down, her name is Nakishi Taifa. That's N-K-E-C-H-I and last name is T-A-I-F-A. Go to our website. Like I said, you can purchase the book from the website, or you can go to a list of black-owned, like she said, black-owned. She says she had a list of over 100 black-owned bookstores where you can purchase the book from. Richard.
Yes.
Interesting time that we spent with her, because her life really, and some of the people and struggles that she was involved in, is like, I don't know how she had time, to be honest. It's wow.
Yeah. And that's the thing about this struggle, Elliot. If I can, it's, you know, people make it like it's not ordinary. You know, we're living ordinary lives, but it's the question: what are we living it for? And I think that's, you know, all of us have to ask that question, right? What are we living our ordinary lives for, especially as Black people? And when you're in that, and then even you coined the frame struggle, doesn't really give it its due justice, because it's trying to bring into being something that, you know, a just society, I'll say it like that. And that ain't easy. It ain't easy. It ain't easy in the reality of making it happen. And it ain't easy in relationship to our personal life. But for us, just like being in what's that? When we were under total physical bondage, you know, that wasn't easy. And look of all the great things that were created out of that as contributions to the world, you know.
Yeah, listen, you're right. And again, for the folks that's on, we are going to transition into open forum the rest of the way. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. You know, Richard, Attorney Taifa said something interesting there when she was talking about what got her involved in, or what got her interested in being a lawyer, when they were studying some things, and I think she said junior high school, and she mentioned the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which we've talked about several times on this program. But she said something that, I mean, I didn't know, but she's an attorney. She said that when that was proposed,
you're supposed to ask.
Exactly. And she said that we were never asked. Now, let's open that up some. Because like I said, we've mentioned that on the program before. Now, the only account where I see that any of our people were asked was when the representative from Lincoln's administration at that time, that general, went down there and asked, I think it was 66 leadership at that time, what they wanted. You remember that, Richard, and some Sherman of our listening audience.
William Sherman.
When Sherman asked, and they with a consensus said that they wanted to be left alone. That they wanted to be left alone and have their own land to develop it. That's what our ancestors said. They wanted to develop it themselves and be left alone. It never happened. But that was the only time I ever seen where anything close to asking the people, our people, what they wanted was ever done. So you're legally off or giving somebody citizenship that never asked you. And if you turn the clock back to that period of time, Richard, unlike now, it's clear to me that the overwhelming majority of our people would have chose to leave this place instead of be here.
And that discussion was, I mean, even just right before the war, right? I mean, that's what Lincoln and what's the name? Douglas was talking about, right? You know, and even if it wasn't the representation, because and I just had what you raised is, so when you talk about unpacking it, it's so important, because when we look at those conventions, and I think the last one was 54 of the Negro. There were contingents who were saying, yeah, we're going to stick it out. And others were saying, we need an independent space of our own, whether it will be here or we go back to the continent, but we need an independent. And that's not developed by white folks talking about the American Colonization Society. But, you know, so what I see, and this is so important, but what's being said when we talk about the in the Black Power, as she's saying, and then those who, you know, Ababa Obadeli and them with the Republic of New Africa talking about the Southern state strategy and having those five states. This is a historical continuum of a particular slice of people who, if asked, would say, this is what I want. And as you said, they basically, that those 66, that's what they said. We want to be in a space to our, and he asked, and he followed up. Well, do you want to, you know, be engaged with white folks? And he said, well, they said no. Not right now.
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't mention that part. They said no.
Right.
They said no.
So if there is a continuum. Now, I ain't saying that was the total, but that was when we're talking about being asked. And if you going to ask, you got to ask. You can't, who, you know, it ain't like we are. And she made that point. That's usually a state-to-state relationship. We were a people. We weren't a state. Even though, as Brother Henderson said, you know, we had created a revolutionary struggle within in the Civil War, which Du Bois called the general strike. But we weren't necessarily a state. So they would have had to been able, but we was organized to the degree that we could be. There was organized resistance to become from, unfreed people to free people. They actually was able to move. They were organized to be able to send delegates for more than just five states to hold different conventions over time to discuss strategies and tactics. So it wasn't like there was no representation, but it wasn't representation like we're this thing called we're a monolith. So, you know, and for me, Elliot, the important thing for me, I want to make sure the listening audience understand and tying it to reparations. Those who felt that it was important to bring the question to the table of repair at some point made a strategic decision, knowing the mindset of our people, well, we're not going to push it from our vantage point, you know, as a provisional government. We're going to just put it out there because all Black people need to be repaired. That's a particular character of a state. Not looking out just for itself, but looking out for all the people it comes out, the historical people it come out of. And I just think that that's important. And that was a decision. It wasn't just something that just happened. That's important to me, Elliot, because the discussion now is like, these things just came out of nowhere, and the people who originated this push, and the reason why I'm pushing reparation, because of all it went. I mean, when she talked about the political prisoners, or the COINTELPRO, all of that was those individuals, that was a part of the dynamics of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the government said they had to squash that. And they were just operating out of defensive posture. It wasn't like you're talking, it wasn't no thing about going and kidnapping no governor.
No. And if you look, Richard, at that, listen, at those times, it was all about conversation, and especially around Black folks doing for self.
Right.
If Black folks were attacked, sure, it was about self-defense, but it was never about an aggressive posture with these people. It was always about, let's almost what the ancestors said, let's get to ourselves, let's try to do for self, let's try to develop spaces that we have of our own. It was always about the conversation around doing for self.
Mm-hmm.
But even the fact of the conversation was dangerous.
Mm-hmm. At the highest level, at the highest level of government. That's what I'm talking about.
Like
really, you know, people have to really understand what, you know, what people are talking about. And I understand what she said, that it's not all serious because, you know, everybody's living their life. I mean, we're people who have been dealing with this. But for some reason,
based off of what you're saying, just at that period. Because, you know, when we talk about those Rosewoods and whatever, when they did create those enclaves, it still wasn't good enough for them. This is at the highest level.
Mm-hmm.
And we ain't talking about just highest level of administrator. We're talking about highest level of military establishment and State Department establishment. That there is some fear. And what is the fear? That our oppression is connected to the oppression of African people around the world.
You know, I'm reading this, and we got a couple calls on the line. I'm going to go to them in a second. I'm reading this article that came out today in U.S. News and Politics. And it says, Biden and Trump say they're fighting for America's soul. And let me read a couple paragraphs. It says, in a phrase that has been constantly invoked by both Democrat and Republican leaders, it has become the clearest symbol in the mood of the country and what people feel is at stake in November. Everybody, it seems, is fighting for it. This campaign is not just about winning votes, but it's about winning the heart and, yes, the soul of America, says Joe Biden. He said in August at the Democratic National Convention. Not long after, the phrase "battle for the soul of America" appeared at the top of the campaign website right next to his name. Picking up on this, a recent Trump campaign spliced videos of Democrats invoking the soul of America, followed by images of clashes between protesters and police, and the words "Save America's Soul" with a request to text "soul" to make a campaign contribution. So both of these parties is talking about saving America's soul. Now, again, Richard, because we've talked about this in the past, about other people setting these narratives and black folks feed into it. Now, what does that mean to black people about this country saving its soul? Now, the country is not an inanimate object. It doesn't think for itself. It doesn't walk. It's folks that run this country and set policy, and they're European. So when you say save this country's soul, you're talking about people. So They use this boogeyman of Trump and his stirring up of white extremists as a rallying cry for black people. Well, to me, listen, white people know that their crazy uncle, and I'll use the term crazy uncle that live in the attic, was up there all the time. This is their crazy uncle. So if he's exposed, that's your problem. It's not mine. It's not mine. White folks and this government entities has been attacking black people from every angle since we've been here. If you're talking about these white extremists going to attack black people, okay, come on with it. Black folks have been taking these punches and dealing with them since we've been here. And we're going to be able to handle anything these people could dish out. That shouldn't make black people shaking their boots and talking about this vote is for life and all this foolishness. Because somebody's crazy uncle in the attic has been exposed. They knew this, the crazy uncle was up there all the time. And I'm just using that term, crazy uncle. They might not consider him the crazy uncle in the attic. They might just consider him a family member. In fact, they are family members. You go to any of these white islands, you're going to see them all there. They're all there with these feelings in reference to the country and in reference to you. Saving the soul of America. I mean, are you kidding? These white folks come up with these narratives, and it grates me. It's almost like somebody's finger on the chalkboard. It grates me when black people buy into this foolishness.
I don't even know how to deal with it, Elliot. Yeah. I mean, it's real, you know, because they just had this week that Supreme Court Justice show, and the one thing I kept hearing is that
She's a she holds the Constitution to the text, the original intent. Mm-hmm. And every time I hear it, I mean, in my mind, well, if we go to the original intent, then we, and I think this lines up through your thought, and it may be a commentary, so, you know, the listening audience can, you know, correct me. But if they go to the original intent, Black folks had a particular place in that original intent. And it wasn't, it didn't even have the modifiers of the 13th, 14th, and the 15th Amendment. Or the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Or the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or whatever that was. That's not a part of the original intent. So, you know, even though, as you say, you know, these guys are having this debate about saving their soul, you know, I take it, you know, and it's always been, we trying to save our behind. I don't know, maybe I'm being now.
Richard, here's another thing, these narratives, and I promise, then I'm going to the phones. I just read about this narrative about saving the souls, and both parties is talking about it, saving America's soul. And the Democratic Party is talking about protecting the middle class.
Hmm.
When all you got to do is look at the economic figures, and you see that the majority of Black folks don't necessarily fall into that bracket. Now, let me just read a paragraph from a couple of these articles to kind of bolster my quote-unquote argument in reference to the middle class and dealing with us. I ain't talking about Europeans. Whatever their middle class is, it is different than Black people's. Even their economic base for the middle class is different than Blacks. And this is something that happened because, you know, Obama bailed out the banks during that recession. But let me just read this. And these come from four separate published reports. This one was in the Jacobin magazine, Black Wealth Destroyed. Even before the crash, and this came from an article in 2017, December of 2017. Even before the crash, decades of discriminatory policies has distressed African-American housing wealth. New Deal federal housing subsidies and the bedrock of the post-war middle class largely locked out African-Americans. Racist housing covenants forbade neighborhoods from selling or renting to Black families, backed up by a threat of riot. Black families that could buy were often brutally exploited by contract sellers. The mortgage bubble fostered similar abuses. Originators looking for anyone to take subprime mortgages handed them out disproportionately to Black middle and lower class people and steered Black middle class families who had qualified for original mortgages into subprime loans as well. Former Wells Fargo employees later testified that the banks deliberately tricked middle-class Black families, who were called mud people, into subprime ghetto loans. Overall, the Center for Responsible Lending study found out that from 2004 to 2008, 6.2% of white borrowers with a credit score of 660 got subprime mortgages. 6%. But 21.4% of Black borrowers did. Now, you see where, now I'm not even talking about what they consider poor Black families, but you see what these banks, big businesses did to what is considered middle class Black families. Because generally your home is something that is really the thing that you spend your most money on and that you can leave. That's the wealth that you can leave to your children. But you see how these banks help destroy that, right, Richard?
Yep.
Now, it mentioned this particular bank, Wells Fargo, other banks was involved. But this particular series of articles is going to focus on Wells Fargo just for the sake of reading. Not that it's better or any different than any of the other lending institutions. Now, it mentioned that in between 2004 and 2008, they was practicing this. I'm quite sure they was doing it all along. But let me read something in reference to the comments made by bank executives. Now, this is from the New York Times of June of 2009. During these hearings, it describes Beth Jacobson describes her and her fellow officers at Wells Fargo Bank rode the stagecoach from hell for a decade, systematically singling out blacks for high-interest subprime mortgages. These loans, officials have claimed in a federal lawsuit against Wells Fargo, tip hundreds of black owners into foreclosure and cost the cities tens of millions of dollars in taxes and city services. Wells Fargo, Ms. Jacobson said in an interview, saw the black community as fertile ground for subprime mortgages, as working-class blacks were hungry to be part of the nation's home-owning mania. Loan officers, she said, pushed customers who could have qualified for prime loans into subprime mortgages. Other loan officers stated in affidavits last week that the employees referred to blacks as mud people and the subprime loans as ghetto loans. So these are the banks and lending institutions that Barack Obama, the shining prince to some black people, helped bail out after they destroyed black families' wealth. And especially, I ain't talking about black poor black families because they was already destroyed. But I'm talking about destroyed so-called middle-class black people's wealth. Now, do you think that stopped, Richard? Wells Fargo was uncovered by these racist practices and using derogatory terms about loans and referring to black people. You think they learned their lesson? Well, let me read from this article from October the 8th, 2020. And it referenced an incident that was uncovered in October of 2015, 5 years earlier. It says residents of Flint had filed a civil lawsuit against three banks for claiming for poisoning the residents of Flint, Michigan's water system during the period when Flint utilized the Flint River as the primary water source without implementing proper corrosion controls, according to the complaint in federal court. Prior to the lawsuit regarding the Flint water crisis, they had been ongoing for years against various government officials and environmental engineering companies that were involved in the decision to switch the water source in Flint. The complaint filed by the U.S. District Court in Eastern Michigan alleges that without the bond backed by three investment banks, Flint would not had been able to pay the KWA pipeline, according to the complaint. J.P. Morgan, Chase, Wells Fargo agreed to underwrite the bond, financing the plan to use raw, untreated Flint River water as an interim drinking source, which would expose Flint residents and water users to lead poisoning and Legionella bacteria. These three banks each engaged in conscious, shocking behavior by underwriting Flint's participation in the KWA and thus poisoning Flint's children, residents, and other users, knowing full well there would be drastic and dire health consequences to the children of Flint, the complaint alleges. Richard, you think those banks stopped? Obama helped bail these banks out that took black people's wealth, and they still doing the same thing. They invested in this company that poisoned black people. That's tantamount to the Tuskegee experiment that poisoned black people, and they knew it.
And they're still living under it now.
Yeah. But if you remember that, I think it was that suit that made them immune from any type of more punishment. These banks, I mean, this Wells Fargo is mentioned again. I'm just saying, I'm not making one bank over another. But I'm saying they were mentioned before with all these mud people loans, ghetto loans. Now they're doing the same thing again, investing in something and knew that our people was going to be poisoned in that city.
And the government allowed it.
And the government allowed it. Just said, wait a minute, the soul of our country. Yeah, come on with this bull crap. I could care less about Trump or Biden. Their crazy uncle in the attic that's running around talking about kidnapping the governor of Michigan. That you deal with it. That's on you. That's your uncle, ain't mine. Let's go to a couple of these calls and see what they got to say. 267. 267, are you there?
Yeah. Yes, Brother Elliot, can you hear me, Brother Richard?
How are you, sir?
Good, man. I wish I could have talked to that woman, man, because I was around Harris Law School around that time, and I knew some people that she probably knew. So I was thinking it's kind of hard to get a black lawyer in Philadelphia to represent you in any case. So when you have somebody who's a black lawyer who's black and conscious, boy, that's rare. But I want to add this, brothers. I want to say to you that when we look at the Supreme Court justice that will probably take the bench, she said that her and her 16-year-old daughter from Haiti saw George Floyd's neck on the curve while a police officer took his time in breaking his neck. I said to myself that the same woman who said that her and her 16-year-old daughter cried would go against affirmative action. She would go against the Health Care Act. She would go against Roe versus Wade. And that black girl that she adopted is this window dressing. So these people who think she has a heart, the way she's going to vote, she's going to show you that she's heartless. I also want to talk about Ice Cube. Here's a man who I thought had a little bit more conscience than that. Somehow he hooks up with the Trump administration, and he's talking about a platinum plan that they're going to give the African-American community, I said the African-American community, $500 billion. I mean, not $500 million, $500 billion and give them a department in the federal government. I said to myself, that's enough to build the infrastructure. You mean to tell me that Donald Trump and his administration will give African Americans $500 billion? Now, I'm going to say this to you. Ice Cube, a Kanye West, a Ben Carson, do they really think, have they bought into this that they really think that they're accepted and that white people see them equal as equals? I mean, have these people who went to Hollywood have lost their mind? Do you really think that the Trump administration is going to convince Barbara Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell to give us $500 billion, Elliot? Give me your opinion on that, Elliot and Richard.
Well, I mean, that's on paper. I mean, you're thinking. I mean, you got your thinking cap on. But some of our people are not thinking. And I'm talking about people that's a Republican or Democrat. They're not. I mean, I've seen that in that platinum plan. In fact, I'm looking right at it. It says increased capital investments in black communities, $500 billion. They don't even want to give one million. I ain't even talking about $500 billion. They don't even want to give $1 million in these communities to do nothing. In fact, all of these cities, Tim, is being gentrified rapidly. And that's done by Republicans. There's a Democratic administration in a lot of these cities that's kicking black folks out of their communities. And when white folks move in, they change everything that show no vestiges of you even being there. They come in, disrespect the community. If you was block captain or whatever, they moving on you. If two or three are moving on your block, all of a sudden they create their own block captain. Go down the city and get all types of stuff right while you sitting there. They just totally disrespect these communities. These are not the so-called crazy uncle in your attic type of white folks. The Boogaloo boys, the Proud Boys. These are not those type of folks. These are the so-called liberal whites that's moving in your area and treating you like dirt. They don't see you as equals. They just don't want no problem out of black folks.
But that, my question to you is that why do our people go to them and look how they pick a Candace Owens? Look how they pick the Attorney General in Kentucky. And you know, if you talk to him, he talks about how he was under Mitch McConnell, like he groomed him like a slave. So my question to you is that why do you even go to him? And he put, you know, look, he wants to do a hocus pocus. The man wants votes. He ain't giving you nothing. He went and told the people in the coal mines of Virginia, I'm going to bring the jobs back. Coal mining, Jack. I'm going to build infrastructure. I'm going to bring back jobs. He ain't did nothing. What are you even around him for?
Well, listen, the reason a lot of them go to him, and I ain't talking about no Kansas. I'm talking about people that's on both sides of the aisle currying favor with these politicians because they don't want to be viewed as you. They don't want to be treated like you, even though some of them look like you. They want to be seen and treated differently. That's the fact. That's the raw facts. See, the only thing different now in our experiences here, when we were on those plantations, Brother Tim, and you had people that worked in the house, you know the terms that was used.
Sure.
When you had people that worked in the house and they felt as though that they were entitled to more privileges than the people in the field, which they were to a certain extent. But at the end of the day, they had to come out of that house because they didn't live in there with those white folks. They came out and went right back to the quarters with everybody else. Right?
Right.
And Richard, you know this.
Yeah.
But these times are different. These black folks, when they curry favor and suck up to all these people, be it Democrat or Republican, they don't necessarily have to come back to the quote-unquote slave quarters and live with you. They can live on the other side of town, in the other enclave where people like them, quote-unquote, live, that don't want to be considered part of you. That's the only difference now than now and 150 years ago. 150 years ago, those used to kiss white man's behind, and like that clip that I play with Cynthia McKinney saying that the one that was hitting Kuta Kinte across the black was a black man. Well, that same black man, he didn't live in that house with those people who he was serving. At the end of the day, when the workday was over, he came right out there to the plantation quarters, the slave quarters with everybody else. People didn't say too much around him. They knew that he would go back and tell everything that he knew to white folks, but he still came out there and was among everybody else. Now, these new breed of blacks, they don't necessarily have to come out and live with you.
That's very well put. That's very well put.
Well, I mean, that was your comment, or you had something more, or what?
I that young lady, hope she comes back again. I'm going to get her book.
Yeah, we'll try.
Black
to, we'll try.
Power, Black Lawyer. I'm going to get that book, man.
We'll try to get her back on because she's and plus, you know, when these things come up, any of these things, we're going to need some legal insight. So I got her number sealed in the Rolodex, Richard. Yeah. Hey, thanks for your contribution, brother.
Indeed. Have a good one. Peace.
Let's go to 267 again. 267, 296, are you there? 267, 296. Let's go to 215. 215?
Good evening, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. How you doing?
Hey, sir. Right. What's up?
I'm doing fine. Our praises be to Allah. Yeah, I enjoy your conversation with Brother Tim and his sister, the lawyer, too. I like Brother Tim. I definitely can't wait to y'all get her back on and stuff, you know. You know, first, I'm going to say my comment about Oprah Winfrey for last. I want to talk first. I'm going to deal with the Ice Cube situation and some of those. I think it was Ice Cube and it might have thought it come to me in a second. But, yeah, on Ice Cube, yeah, you know, when you talked about when Brother Tim mentioned about how he, through people like Ice Cube and you know, the rest of them, Ben Carson, Candace Owens, all the rest of them Negroes, do they think that they've been accepted?
No. Wait a minute. Let me say this. He didn't necessarily put Ice Cube in that bag with Candace Owens and them. He was mentioning them in something else. But he was making comments that how he didn't understand how Ice Cube could work with Republicans. But he didn't put them in a bag with Candace Owens or Ben Carson.
Well, I didn't mean it that way. Well, I meant it was just in the sense that whether it's Candace Owens or whether it is Ice Cube, depending on what level he's dealing with these people, do they think they accept it, in the sense that, you know, how people, when they get that certain economic status, they think they truly are accepted by these people? Because remember, Elliot, the other day I was telling you about Ice Cube's bandmate, the late Eazy-E. I said that he was, when he was at the height of their popularity, before Eazy-E got sick and died, you know, he was, 3 years prior to that, he was invited to the George Bush White House, the first Bush. He had got an invite to a state dinner up there in D.C. with Bush, and he was with all these dignitaries and stuff. And he actually thought he was important. I mean, he actually thought these people liked him. He was like, why would they pick me? I'm just a old black man from Compton, California, a gangster rapper, no less. Well, I must be something special for them to invite me. And so he didn't look at it for what it was, that, you know, he was just being used as a useful tool. Because remember, it was all during that time, you had the Rodney King situation, all that stuff was happening around the same time. So getting a guy like him as a face, that we ain't racist, you know, we feel your pain. We seen what happened to Rodney King. We feel your pain. So he was a useful tool for propaganda reasons, purposes, no less. You understand what I'm saying, you know? So he didn't look at it that way. I guess he thought he was important. He thought he was one of the, you know, he was accepted. I think that's the mistake. Like you know, a lot of us make them when they reach that certain level, whether it be Oprah Winfrey, because Oprah, she has got her wake-up calls over the years, but she still, I guess, put it this way, she's in denial about it. Like when she was over in London, and that white, England or France, one of them European countries she was in, and that white owner treated her like she was a black woman from the hood, you know, even thought she was a thief. So they found out who she was, then all of a sudden they were, you know, with the apologies and open with her, and her dense head, you know, not exactly conscious as she is. She went on and brought out half the store, brought a whole bunch of stuff out of the store. She should have told them to take that store and their money and their merchandise and stick it to where the sun don't shine. But, you know, being the kind of monster she was, she went on and showed them, I can show y'all racist white folks, I got money, I ain't got the steel. So she went and brought everything, put money in them biggest pocket, you know what I mean? So, you know, that's the kind of mindset you're dealing with some of a lot of our people. You know, they take those insults and they say, well, I'm gonna show you biggest. I can show you better. I can tell you. I can buy your stuff. I can buy the store out. You know, so you know that's the mindset you're dealing with. You know, but again, you know, I always look at things from this standpoint, Ellen Richard, whether it be an Ice Cube or anyone. I always watch the people who they deal with, and like you said, the people who's funding them, who's pushing them. Because I'm like, yeah, I don't care about whether they meet with Trump or I could care less whether they meet with Trump or Biden, because at the end of the day, they both still white men. You understand what I'm saying? So I don't care who they meet with. You know what I mean? It's just my bottom line is, what's your agenda? What is your end game? You know, what is, who are you truly, the people that you teaming up with and stuff, are they truly got the interests of black people at heart? That's my whole bottom line, you know what I mean? Cause, you know, because at the end of the day, like you said, Elliot, whether it be Biden or whether it be Trump, you see what time it is, you know what I mean? I mean, who would ever thought you live in a country here that's 2020 and you got white boys openly talking about they're going to kidnap a sitting governor? They stormed some of the same type of white boys stormed the state house. Remember prior to when COVID-19 first, you know, start hitting things hard, when the white boys stormed the courthouse in Michigan with guns. You remember Ellen Richard?
Yeah, in Michigan.
In Michigan, right, same state of Michigan. And that was done. I mean, again, you could just put a black face to it. Imagine black men with guns, whether it was legal gun owners or not, storming a state house anywhere in this country, be it Michigan or Pennsylvania, anywhere. And you could just know what the bloodshed that would have followed. But these white boys was allowed to do this, and it's just part of American law, if you will. You know, it's part of American law. It's accepted, you know what I mean? And Trump, and you see Trump up and up there, and he just said the other, yesterday, to the woman, lock them up, lock her up, you know, lock them all up. I mean, just egging these people on. I mean, like you said, like, if it wasn't so serious in the sense of you know, especially for our people, if Trump loses, it would almost be comical. Because like you, Ellie, a lot of times I take the stance you take. I look at Trump sometimes as comic relief, you know what I mean? When he says, indeed, he's dumb, you can't help but laugh because it's funny, but he's funny, but he's dangerous too in a sense. So you try to balance both of them out when you deal with this character, man, because I mean, it's like something you watch out of a movie, at a B-movie, man. You know what I mean? And this guy's supposed to be the president of the United States, and he come across like a complete buffoon. And I'm being nice saying that, you know what I mean? But again, this is what white America has voted for, and this is what white America deserves, you know what I mean? They deserve a guy like him in so many ways, you know? So, I mean, he's America. You know, when you look at Trump, it's for what it is, he's America, you know? I don't think I can make it no more clear than that he represents a white America, you know what I mean, and stuff. So, I mean, you know, and like you said, I close with these last couple of comments. Like you said, our people, we fighting so hard to, like you say, to use that term, saving America. You know, we want the soul of America. I mean, like, when has America ever been some kind of soulmate for black people? Yet, you know, but yet we've, for some of us, we more patriotic than these white folks is. Like I say, you have people call the local terrestrial black station. They still get up there and they say our DNA is in this country. You know, our blood is in this country, which it is. I get all that part, but we fighting for that. We want to save it. We want to, you know, we patriotic. We love this country. Like Doc Rivers, the sixth Karen Koch said, we keep loving a country that sure as hell don't love us back. You know what I mean? But yet we still loyal as hell as can be. You know what I mean? No matter what, we know we as loyal as can be, no matter what atrocities happen. And my other comment on Prince George's County, and I tied this up with Oprah real quick. Yeah, as you see, when you said about how no matter what, how much money you have or what place you live, I don't know if Richard heard. Now, this happened to be a black cop that did it, but it doesn't matter because black cops are just like white cops in a sense. They got a self-hatred. They got a hatred towards their own people as well. And Prince George's County, where they just settled with the family of the young black man that was shot back in January by the black cop, Michael Owen. He gunned down an unarmed black man in Prince George's County, which you and Richard know, Ellis, was the wealthiest black suburb in the United States. It has actually more wealth than some white communities have. But my point is that it still hasn't made the black people, even though you got doctors and lawyers. As a matter of fact, I got family living in Prince George's County. They got $500,000 homes, all that kind of stuff. But the bottom line, Brother Ellen Richard, it still hasn't made them immune from police brutality, you know? They still get shot down, beat down. And matter of fact, this young man that got killed in January, he was the third black man over the last 10 years. Now, that might not seem like a lot, but still, I mean, life is a life, whether it happens once or twice. He's the third or fourth young black man that was killed in Prince George's County by the police. Now, the other brothers that was killed by white cops, but this brother that was killed in January, he was killed by a black cop in January of this year. So, I mean, just to show you, know, I mean, it doesn't make them immune from the madness and the racism, the degradation, the disrespect, the lack of humanity to show towards them, you know. And stuff, you know, they're the wealthiest suburb in America, which have a median wealth of more than some white suburbs. But again, they don't shield them from the, like Minister Farrakhan said in that clip you and Richard played, the harsh realities of black life in America. You know what I'm saying, Ellen Richard? The harsh reality of black life in America. I think that says it all, doesn't it?
You got it.
You know, and lastly, on Oprah, I closed this last comment. When Brother Otis was on Friday, he made a comment about Oprah, how people like Oprah them a lot of times, and I hope I'm quoting Brother Otis right, how they don't make no decisions. We think they calling the shots, but they not. Well, see, to me, it just crystallized for me, not that I needed to her, but I'm glad Brother Otis kind of clarified it for everybody. Well, again, it's no wonder why the whole time Oprah was on ABC, even her so-called own network, she has never had, like I said, Minister Farrakhan on her show. She's never had Reverend Jeremiah Wright as a guest, even though she attended church service. She was a mama there during the time the Obamas was there, but yet she can have the Ku Klux Klan on there calling black people the N-word. She can have that old racist Mark Furman with his racist bigot itself, you know, with the N-word. She can interview these mistreatments and stuff like that, but she can't have Minister Farrakhan on because, again, she ain't calling no shots. When them white Zionists or Jews jump Oprah, Oprah asks how high. So she ain't calling no shots. But like I said, with all the money she got, she's nothing pretty much but a figurehead. But again, you know, you're not allowed to say that because you've been attacked. It's like your comment, Ellen, you said about Obama. You said the so-called black shining prince for some black people. Any criticism, even to this day, will beat you scorn and everything. You know what I mean? But we can't let that deter us. We got to call a spade. You know, we got to call, whether it's Obama, Oprah, we got to call these people out when they doing stuff that's detrimental to black people. I don't care about what they say about me. They can call me whatever they want. I could care less. I'm going to speak out against these people. They doing things that's not being beneficial to our people, and we have to continue to do that. We got to continue to push back. That's all, you know. But anyway, Ellen Richard, thanks for the time, brothers. I'll get off and let another caller on. Ellen, put me on mute, my brother.
I'll do that. Thank you for your call. Let's take another brief break, and coming to the last portion of the program, and we got a couple calls on the line. We got New York City and two other callers. And we'll take those calls right at the break. You can kind of slip in here before we leave the air tonight at 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're coming down the home stretch. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I say that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Greene sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back. The time for an awakening is 9:10 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're coming down the home stretch. Time for an awakening. You can try to slip in here and get a call in by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, it's 215-490-9832. Richard, let's go back to the, unless you got a comment, let's go back to the phone.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to be too long on it, but it, you know, what's going on generated a thought, but I'll
go ahead.
You know, it was two thoughts in the sense of one that was Sister Taifa, you know, again bringing out the genealogy of H.R. 40 and in Cobra and her and experience there, and I think that, you know, raising and being, you know, observational, that looking over the 30 years before Down is getting traction, and the question of, well, why now, and who. And how that's coming out, as she said, you know, I mean, political presidential candidates were, you know, potential candidates were making reference to it, states, cities, and, you know, are now promoting the ideal of reparations. Why? That's interesting, especially now when it's being tailored, you know, to coming up with identifying what would be the means for redress, which I don't hear us really addressing. Professor Darity has his, you know, in his book, you know, it laid out a potential process to where a reparations program can be implemented in the amount of $20 trillion. So I think what we heard so many billions, you know, it's, you know, that's, 20 trillion is interesting, but I assume that, and I believe there's other programs out there, and that's what this, the HR 40 is saying is supposed to be assembling to evaluate which one would be a one. So it'll be interesting to have that discussion. How many programs are out there, which would be beneficial? But the other thing, you know, and the reason why, you know, it was taking too long, because this segment of the population where we are right now, I was always going through, you know, looking at it from a point of history and looking at Haynes Walton Jr. Black politics and parties, political parties, and as a deal with Black people, and going to the political formation, say, of the Federalist Party. The Federalist Party was primarily Washington, Hamilton, which was the banks, and that's what you were raising earlier about, you know, the behavior of the banks, right? But that party, those free Blacks in New York and Philadelphia, you know, in the 1790s, late 1780s, 1790s, they politically were aligned with the banks. You know, when you talk about the, you know, quote unquote Black middle class, particularly, they were politically aligned historically to the parties of the banks. And I think that that's, you know, I'm always extrapolating from then to now. And one thing that, you know, another part that got me that, you know, I think her name, that's how you say her name, Marisha Bararana, The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. She said when she was put in there talking about Hamilton said you had to emphasize that successful banking required strong partnership with the federal government. He told Congress in 1790 that a bank is not a mere matter of private property, but a political machine of the greatest importance to the state. A healthy government needed a bank to survive, and strong banks relied on government support. So, you know, and then that, like, that brought two things, because, you know, you're talking about a certain group of Black people now are, you know, whether they deal with the, you call it the Republican Party, but there's alignment with the banks, and you know, banks are offering, you know, how they're going to help Black America. Morgan Chase said they're going to put out $30 billion for, you know, Black bank. Now, is that the Platinum Plan? How much they're saying in the government they're talking about? Is that?
They said $500
billion. $500 really? Well, that's $500 billion supposed to come from the government, $30 billion coming from a bank, Citibank saying $1 billion. And you know, so they're, but all of this is under the moment of reparations. But the thing, what Sister Taifa said also, that the initial thrust came out of individuals who were looking for a sovereign, you know, to be under sovereign control, but recognizing they was going to open it up and not open it up, but allow it to grow so that the general public would identify with the need for reparations. And this goes to the cultural aspect, and you know, Elliot, you know, I'm down with Brother Earl Henderson and his book, and I'm hoping, you know, these three books that I mentioned, that people hopefully they catch it, you know, listen to the podcast if I'm talking too fast, and catch it and go through this, because it's important to see that what we're looking at is strategies, cultural strategies that's going on, to maintain a particular a colony, and you need certain people to be engaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
And with you know, Professor Henderson in The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, you know, being at the point now, he was saying not only, you know, Du Bois and Alain Locke, but now his name just went, Cruz, you know, was saying that culture is the mechanism, right? Culture is the mechanism that we have to deal with our particular revolution. And in this particular section that Professor Henderson raises, says the Negro movement must challenge free enterprise at its weakest link, that in the production chain where no tangible commodity are produced. This becoming the economic. And what's that weakest link? The cultural piece. Now, who, I think Friday, you know, read the article, it was 600 and so many billion billionaires, and seven billion black billionaires. Five of them came out of the entertainment arena.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the cultural aspect, right? And then and they're usually those individuals, when you look at that, they're the ones that are now giving political persuasions. And then look at the other two that we're in as we move towards the election, two come out again out of the cultural matrix, right? I don't have nothing personally one way or another. I'm just trying to look at make the analysis in a broader sense. They come out of the culture. Ice Cube is an entertainer. P. Diddy is an entertainer. They have the mindset. They have the buy-in from the cultural matrix of the millennial generation, particularly, right? And look, there are now the political liaisons. It's interesting. And who are they making overtures to? They're making overtures to the system that has deliberately denied the investment within the black community out of a political strategy that you raised in the articles that you use using Wells Fargo. But what do they bring? They bring the control over the population, because as Brother Cruz said in Rebellion and Revolution, the cultural matrix is how, and Brother Henderson in putting this book together is saying the cultural matrix is what we are aligned with. It's not a tangible, but it produces, it's a commodity, and these are the cultural leaders. And they're bringing a population. And where are they bringing them? Do they bring them to where we're organizing around ourselves to do what those brothers did and telling General Sherman that we wanted to be able to organize on our own? They're bringing it automatically to the taking a plan to these two, what you call them, the two white operators trying to save the soul of America. They're bringing in a plan to them, and that we're going to benefit from them. I mean, we being the masses of black folks. I don't know if I made sense, Elliot, but it just seems that unknowingly we're looking at a historical movement that we have to be conscious of a segment of the black population that has positioned themselves to be able to benefit regardless who wins the election, regardless what party is in place. And in using the tools that the government allows, because if they were going to be independent, the COINTELPRO or the Black Identity Extremists, they say if you enunciate you want to have sovereign thinking, sovereign, operate out of sovereign, a sovereign being, you become extremist. But if you want to be white and take out a governor, it's questionable. Are you an extremist? That, I don't know if that's two different standards, but to be American, but that sounds like two different standards to me. That's what our conversation to this point stimulated. I apologize for going on.
No, listen, what you're saying is, when I read from that FBI report on black identity extremists, it says what they considered wasn't a black identity extremist. In fact, I got it on this desk here right in front of me. It says black identity extremists, and this is from the unclassified FBI report on threats, domestic threats. Black identity extremists use force or violence in violation of criminal law in response to perceived racism and injustice in American society. Some do so in furtherance of establishing a separate black homeland or autonomous black social institutions, communities, or governing organizations within the USA, or desire physical or psychological separation, and is typically based on a religious or political belief system, which is sometimes formed around or included in the belief of racial superiority or supremacy, retaliation, and retribution for perceived wrongdoings against African Americans, and has become an organizing driver for black identity extremists. Some black identity extremists desire separation from perceived oppressive forces in law or personnel or other oppressive forces which are viewed as participants in this perceived unjust institutional system.
And not one time can they say, and as you said, and Sister Taifa said earlier, that black people have made, other than under chattel enslavement, when we talk about the Nat Turners and the Denmark Veseys, you know, have ever made a physical act. I ain't saying that we didn't have perceived we've been wrong, and even said we wanted to have, but made a physical act against this government. But you got people who, and that's just for us to talk about, because it's just talk. That, because, and that's in their history. Mm. The Shea Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion. I mean, these militias going on against the government, that's not no new thing. So taking out a governor, but it's not a new thing in America, you know, in white America, as you say, and trying to save that soul, right? Or would you say the crazy uncle in the attic, right? This ain't new. But they cannot be able to say that we have made any aggressive act again. Yeah, talk. You know, Negroes talk. But have not made no move, but even believing that it's important for us out of our own public health or health concern to be on our own is considered to be an extremist.
That's extremist, yeah.
To have the thought, to perceive it, or to talk about it, is to be an extremist. And therefore, it's at the highest level of government. Like Garvey. Garvey never took no physical action. But to perceive that we were a global people and bring people together,
it was a threat. Both here, both domestically and foreign. It was a meeting against him in Europe and here. Let's go to
over again. That's, I mean, you know, what can we say?
Let's go to 773-773.
You got me, brother?
Yep.
I want to thank you two young brothers for taking my call. Jim, I'm going to let the record show I'm going to pretend to vote for Jim Crow Joe. I always pick the lesser of the evils, and that's what I'm going to do this time. Now, many people thought the Klan, George Wallace, Hitler, Mussolini, people thought they was funny too. So don't be thinking people ain't going to have to kill you. Because you think they funny. Donald Hitler might look funny, act funny, talk funny, but he's a nasty psychopath creating an atmosphere where millions of black people can be slaughtered. Now, Brother Elliot, you said we can deal with anything that these psychopaths can dish out. I disagree. I admire your passion and courage. That's absolutely. But the masses are slaves here, Brother Elliot. They are not prepared for war against the greatest killer that ever walked the earth in his homeland. All the people who had a chance of standing up to him, He was over in their homeland. If you in his homeland, and he's the greatest killer that ever walked the planet, you don't have a chance. Now, there's many black people, men and stuff, ready to prepare to fight. I got that. But you can't protect millions of women and children and have food for them, health care. Now, I was in Vietnam. The fighters, the Vietnamese who was fighting America, they was in the jungle, hit and run, sniper, plant booby traps. But the Vietnamese people who was left in them villages, baby, they was dog meat. American soldiers came in there and did what they wanted to do with them. Raped them, killed them, burned the village down. They did it all. Many of you all old enough, you know that. Now, there's a trick being played on us today, as the psychopaths always do with the slaves. Many cities talking about giving the slaves reparation. That is a trick. Here comes Billy Bob again with his trick. Why black people always want the ones got to get reparation from some city or from this county or this city down the road? Other people didn't get reparation like that. Other people got reparation from governments, national governments. Slavery was all over this world, France, England, Britain, America. So how we look in some suburb somewhere talking about they giving us reparation? That is a trick. That is buffoonery. Now, I'm going to close with this, brother. I'm going to let y'all go, and I appreciate you. If you want to save your life, if you got some young child, grandson, daughter, if you want to save their life, if you got somewhere to send them and get them out of here, get them out of here. There is a white supremacist power structure that runs Earth and space. I know a lot of black people don't want to hear that. There is a white supremacy power structure that runs Earth and space. They have decided that the Negro time in America is up. That's why they got Donald Hitler in. Mr. Hitler did not overthrow the power structure in Germany. There was no revolution in Germany to bring in Mr. Hitler. Listen, there was no revolution in Italy to bring in Mussolini. The power structure in those countries put those psychopaths in to do exactly what they did. The power structure in America that runs Earth and space, they put Donald Hitler in to do exactly what he's doing. He is supposed to let chaos ring, and the world is supposed to see chaos ringing in America. That prepares the world for the slaughter that they have planned for us. Now, many people said, Brother X crazy, I don't believe that stuff, man, you wrong. Brother, I hope I'm wrong. Because if I'm wrong, millions of black people are not going to be slaughtered. But if I'm right, millions of black people, they are about to be slaughtered. The process of understanding or perceiving a coming evil has put many people into a situation of the utmost danger. That simply means, people, the masses of humans that have been exterminated in the past, they never saw extermination coming. They saw themselves being treated unfairly. They saw themselves being brutalized. One killed him, one killed there. But they had no idea that the people doing this to them had plans to exterminate them in mass. That is exactly where I see us at right now. You got a UN headquarters up in New York. I done said this before. They for human rights and crap. Black people getting shot down in the streets on camera. You don't hear nothing from no damn UN. Black caucus. You don't hear nothing from them damn people. You had four presidents went down in Texas by the damn flood. They ain't got nothing to say about this nasty psychopath in the White House creating an atmosphere of terror, violence. They ain't got nothing to say about him. Barack Obama, George Bushwhacker, went down in Alabama to the Edmund Pettus Bridge commemorating Bloody Sunday. They ain't got nothing to say about this psychopath. Where's those past presidents? Jimmy Peanut Collar, oh, he loved people so. He all over the world building houses. They ain't got nothing to say about this atmosphere here. These psychopaths running around in salt weather, threatening people, acting crazy. All these former presidents who love America so, they ain't got nothing to say about this crap.
What you want them to say?
They supposed to call it out. That's my point on Hitler and Mussolini.
They're not going to call it out. You know why? They're not going to call it out. You know why?
Right.
See, I agree with you on a lot of things, Brother X, but the assertion you make that they want the world to see this, Europeans don't want the world to see this.
They don't want the world to see what?
You said that Europeans want the world to see this happening here.
Yeah, but they want the world to see us being shot down on camera, brutalized and terrorized to set
no,
the
were,
table
you were ta- you were talking
for the extermination.
About, you were talking about the just chaos of Trump and others and what's going on here, and they want the world to see this because it's building towards something else.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. They don't want the world to see this. It's nothing they can do to stop it. It's already being seen. They don't want to. America and Europeans like to go to other people's countries and show their dysfunction, their leadership in so-called chaos. And if it's not in chaos, they create chaos in other people's countries so they can say, we're the paragon of virtue and look at these people. They don't want the world seeing this type of stuff here. So you thinking that Carter, Bush, Clinton, Obama going to say something necessarily about this man? I'm talking about beat the drum around the world that he's in dysfunction. They're not going to do that because they don't want the world. They want the world to still see them in some form of unity, no matter if it's not. They don't want the world to see this. It's certain things that they're not in control of. So I don't agree that he's in control of this world and space. I don't agree with that.
Well, my point, my good brother, was...
Because he do not, I want you to understand, he do not want the world to see this happening here, his country in dysfunction.
If the market falls, he don't want the world to see that either.
Huh?
If he don't want them to see it, why he don't act to stop it?
Well, I don't know why he don't act to stop it. This man, who knows?
That's what I'm telling you. If he's not acting to stop it, then that is what he wants to be seen.
Okay.
That's my point.
Well, finish what
they
you said.
They control mass media, Brother Elliot, not us. They were the same.
They control
what
media here.
See across the world.
They control the media here. They don't control.
No, they control mass media.
Okay,
across the
well,
world.
That, because you believe they control everything. Well, I don't agree with that. They
okay,
don't.
What mass media they don't control in the world?
Do other countries have medias of their own?
Yeah, but they white supremacists.
Who? Oh,
France,
every country
France,
is a white supremacist.
Canada?
Every country is a white supremacist.
No.
Oh, then what you talking about?
No,
these other countries.
The ones that run the world. They are white supremacists.
Come on, they think they run the world. You just said every media is white supremacist, and it's not. You got other people's media here in the world?
What other people's mass media is here?
Okay, never mind.
I'm just wondering. I need your school.
Yeah, it's plenty of media. It's plenty of media that's not
with white supremacy mass media.
What are you talking about? They compete. Now you're talking about compete. You're changing the argument. I ain't talking about nobody competing with anybody. It's other media beside this U.S. and European media. It's other media.
Who dominates media?
Now you're changing the argument about somebody dominating it. Okay, well, you finished
your point. Who dominates media in the world?
I want you to finish
what
your point.
What are people going
to
see and hear?
Okay, never mind, brother.
All right, but thank you for this time. But let me close with this, people. The people we are dealing with, they are sick. They are psychopaths. They put Donald Hitler in. He is supposed to act crazy. Many black people said, man, that guy crazy. Look what he's doing. He's supposed to act crazy. They said Hitler was crazy. They said Mussolini, George Wallace, the Klan is crazy. They are supposed to act crazy because they're bringing in something that's going to be even crazier. This is a setup. Thank you, brother. I appreciate you taking the call.
Talk to you soon. Hey, Richard, you kind of leave me out there to dry there. You know, come on, man.
I said I'm not in. I mean, because it made me reflect. Is my commentary so absolute in our inability to survive? Exterminate is a very absolute term, and I don't know at the point of making a what's that word prognostication. That we're going to be exterminated compared to a critical analysis. This is the state of the system as it is now, and the question of what, so that we can be able to develop, so that we can develop whoever that we is, so that we will not be exterminated. And I don't know if I, as I listen, to the brother, I don't know if. Are we saying the same thing? And I really wish that I'm not, even though I'm making the analysis of these are the pieces in play. And when you make that absolute term, what can you say? If a person say, we're going to be exterminated, and you say, no, we're not, like, what can you say to them? That's, I don't know. I apologize for leaving you out there. But I was just kidding.
Right, you ain't leave me out there. I was just kidding with you. Ain't no problem. I think it's a little volume or something up in your background because I hear some, I hear double speak. Let's go to 646. 646.
Yeah, what's going on, Richard and Elliot?
Listen,
I just wanted to say to you, Brother Elliot, in regards to Friday night, I did a little bit of research after I spoke with you. What I gathered, and I'm still working on this, in regards to Brother Ice Cube is, number one, in regards to that proposal that he put together, there was a think tank, from what I understand, that he spoke with. I think he also spoke with Antonio Moore of ADOS and some other economists. Now, I don't know if he spoke with Sandy Darby, who I know has been on your show, because from what I've been gathering, I don't think Sandy Darby is with Yvette Cornell and Antonio Moore in ADOS, from what I'm gathering from just reading a couple of things. But I don't know. Probably the person that could say more that in regards to it is Otis. But also, he hasn't revealed who the people are that put together his program. So that will be, I guess, spoken at some point in time when it's all said and done. Like I said, as far as I'm concerned, the brothers shouldn't have gotten no type of pushback whatsoever in regards to what he was trying to do, because neither one of them, Trump or Biden, is going to do a damn thing for our people. Let's be clear. our people are so confused. They can't even understand that Donald Trump has never indirectly done anything to black folks to harm us that he hasn't done to white folks to harm them also. So you cannot say that about Joe Biden, as our good brother, Brother X, just said, Joe Jim Crow Biden. So if we as a people aren't intelligent enough to be able to tell the difference between one devil and the other devil, then that's not my problem. I know who the devil is. Now, getting to the last point. In regards to Ice Cube in 3-on-3 basketball, now, I've gotten this information from some people that I know that's in the sports industry. Ice Cube went to a number of other blacks and asked them to come in and invest in the 3-on-3. And a lot of blacks thought that it wasn't a good idea. So like all most business deals and transactions, they passed. He then went to his business associate and business partner on other projects that they've done together in regards to movies. The Jew you was talking about. And from my understanding, him and the Jew are 50-50 partners. Now, as a businessman myself, and you're a businessman, I don't think Richard is a businessman, but if I go to my people and I say to them that I have a project and I'd like to do the project and they tell me no, then I'm going to take the project someplace where I can get financing for the project if I have a passion to really do it. And if I decide if I have a relationship with a Jew, which I've done business with Jew indirectly, but I have no relationship with a Jew on that level, I'm going strictly on 50-50. And that is from what I understand Ice Cube has with this Jew who he's done business with for years. So I don't have no problem with Ice Cube working with a Jew. Now, if you have a problem with him working with a Jew, or you think that he should work with a Jew, then that's on you, baby. On me, it's about having equal control, who say so, and the paperwork is right. I don't get caught up in stuff like that. That's why you have to be in a situation to understand that, number one, Ice Cube is not an independent African. So that's where the issue comes into play from jumpstart. He may be saying he wants to do things for black people, which I support. But you can't classify him as an independent black man if his relationships has basically, as he evolved into the movie industry, has always been with the Jew. Like, if we're going to be honest, most entertainers' relationships are in that industry with the Jew or some other white person. I don't know very few individuals in the entertainment business that don't have Jewish representation, partnership, or something in regards to whatever field of entertainment they're in. Now, what I always say is, because of the situation, if it ain't 50-50 equal partnership, then I walk away from it. Now, there's a difference as you step out of that industry and that field to where as you may have more of a say-so. So I think we need to be clear when we classify people and try to label them as something that they really aren't. He's not a nationalist. He may have talked that talk back in the day, but believe me, in the circles that he roll in and what he do, he's not a nationalist. He's not a revolutionary, but I will give him respect and credit. He has enough of an initiative to want to do something for black people. Now, if one has a problem with that, then that's their issue. That's not my issue. Because first of all, I understand the bigger picture. And I understand who he's associated with. And I understand who he rolls with. And unfortunately, we as a people ain't in a position to finance anything because we don't trust each other. We don't love each other. We don't respect each other. And those that have the position to do it, they want to be too close to the daddy. So whereby that's why you got all these crazy Negroes running out here backing a man who over 40-some years has tried to kill and enslave your people, and you think that he's going to save you. All because the other devil talk to you and treat you like most white men do behind your back. He just a little more upfront about it. So please, brother, next time you try to come after me, at least let me explain to you myself like you have this evening. And let's be clear and hope you know I know who the enemy is and I have no problems with who my enemy is. But I also understand those who perceive themselves to be our friends and ally ain't always a friend and an ally. But I will say this about Ice Cube. I give the brother credit because at least he has the initiative to try and do something for our people instead of just getting into bed with somebody who had already raped them. So that's where I'm coming from. So I just want to be clear with you. The bottom line is that people are criticizing Ice Cube. They have a right to criticize him, but understand the real scope of things. And always remember what he said. He's doing it for ADOS. Always remember that Joe Biden's plan for so-called Black America incorporates every other ethnic group. And if history tells us or teaches us anything, whenever it's every other group involved, ADOS gets nothing. So that's why I say, okay, I'll listen to what the brother said and what the brother's trying to do it. Now, is Trump going to do anything? He ain't going to do nothing. Is his plan a joke? Yeah, it's more of a joke than what Joe Biden planned is, but the truth of the matter is Joe Biden plan is just as dangerous and more not dangerous for ADOS because ADOS thinks as though he's going to do something for him, but in the process, like his partner Kamala Harris told us already, she's not going to do nothing for black people. So do we understand each other a little better now?
No, because a lot of the things that you mentioned was never said. I didn't mention anything about being a nationalist. I don't know where you got that from.
No.
And you keep mentioning about... Wait a minute. You didn't talk for about 15 minutes uninterrupted. Did you? Now, you mentioned about Ice Cube being a nationalist. Nobody said that. Richard didn't say it. I didn't say it. I don't know how that got involved in the conversation. You keep mentioning about ADOS. What does ADOS have to do with this conversation? Who mentioned ADOS? You did. You mentioned about him being a nationalist just now. And I keep hearing ADOS mentioned in this conversation. You're saying that. Don't mix that into anything you perceive me to have said or Richard said. if you were listening to the conversation in the beginning, I mentioned about being critical of black people until they reveal their hand. I wasn't critical of what he was doing. The only thing I question is who he was involved with. Now, I don't give a damn what he does in his own personal business. That's what he does. And there's a 50-50. I don't know about all this 50-50 stuff, because when they first put it out, it was him and LL Cool J that was involved in this. Richard read Friday about another white dude that had sued him that was loosely involved with the Trump administration. Right, Richard? What was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, he being 50-50 with another white guy, then what percentage does these other people have? So maybe you better do a little more research on that 50-50 stuff. But like I said before, you going to let me finish? You going to let me finish? You was uninterrupted. You going to do this again? You was uninterrupted for 15 minutes.
I didn't say anything.
You don't hear yourself talking?
I thought you were finished. Go
no,
ahead.
I'm not finished.
Okay.
Now, you know, him going to political entities, talking about a contract for black America. He's not talking about a contract for Ice Cube or his family. He can go to whoever and talk to whoever, Jews, Italians, he can go to whoever. He's talking about a contract for black America. He didn't have no town hall meetings, no meetings in various cities to get people's opinions, to network with activists, to network with other people that have been doing research in these veins on reparations for a number of years. I didn't know of any talks he's had with people. Who's involved with him in this? That was my whole question. Who is involved? If he didn't say it, then there's reasons why he didn't say it. Because it should be no secret. We had a guest on a little while ago that was dealing with the period of the 60s. And you had two voices out there that was for black people, Malcolm and Martin. Everybody knew who Martin was affiliated with or involved with. Everybody in the grassroots community and these so-called enemies of his, not so-called, and the enemies of ours knew exactly who he was involved with. King was pushing different ideologies. And some black folks was critical of it, but they knew exactly who was involved with King. Everybody. Stokely and all of them, until they decided to bow out. Everybody, every black person, and Richard, you can attest to it. Every black person knew who was involved with those men. It was no secret to the black community because it affected their lives. You got somebody that's going to political entities. I don't care who it is. That's going up to political entities talking about a contract for black America, and you don't know who's involved with them, and you don't think it's a problem, then have at it. You don't think it's a problem. I do. That's it.
Well, did not Yvette Carnell.
Well, I don't care about no Yvette Carnell. I don't care about the Yvette. Who is, listen, you stated your opinion on the matter. That it didn't matter to you. I just told you that it matters to me. When somebody claims that they're speaking for the black community and you don't know who's involved, it should matter to black folks. That's it.
Yeah, but the point is, if it does matter, then nobody has the right to do anything unless they get approval for the Negroes that been doing something for all these years and ain't really accomplished nothing. AKA
yeah, well, now you're bringing other things. You're bringing other things into it. Stick to the subject that you're talking about. Listen. Hold up. Listen here. Nobody mentioned, and I told you this before, and we basically wind up to the end of the program. Nobody mentioned anything about an ADOS. Nobody mentioned anything about Ice Cube being a nationalist. Nobody even mentioned, you just mentioned Yvette Carnell. Nobody's talking about any of that. If you want to talk about that, then change the subject and talk about something else. But I'm not talking about that because I didn't mention anything in reference to those entities in the conversation that I was talking about. If you're dealing with me something I said, then deal with something I said, not something that you think I said or that you want me to say.
But don't you see that's all in the same context?
No, no, it's not. And I just explained to you how.
We just beg to disagree on that. That's
no problem.
It ain't no major thing. We just differ because you see it one way, I see it one way. But there's no problem. I mean, to me, it's kind of interesting that here we are as a people in a position where we're attacking somebody based on things that we shouldn't even be attacking them on in response.
Who was attacking anybody?
Protection of a white man.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
You,
who was trying
not
to
saying you?
What are,
I,
hold
you
it. You're not saying me. Wait a minute. You're not saying me. That's what you're talking. You're talking about something I said.
I'm talking about the people who attacked Ice Cube.
Well, then deal with them about that. Deal with them about that.
Did people not call up your show and speak about Ice Cube before I made my comment because I was the last person? Did people not call up the show and said they had issue with Ice Cube because of what he did? Yes or no?
I don't know, to be honest.
Okay. All right, bro. All right, I get you. I think if my ears are kind of good in my memory, you know, I'm getting that age where sometimes you forget a little. I think Little Joe said a little something about it.
Okay, about so what did that got to do with me? What's that got to do with me?
No. Because, like you said, I was just responding about the situation. On the whole, it don't have nothing to
do with you. It don't have nothing to do with me. You started your conversation now talking about something I said,
well,
and you want to reply.
I was replying to what you had said on Friday.
I know it. So what that got to do with anybody else?
That's what I was talking about.
I don't care. Listen, I don't care nothing about who he's involved. He could be involved with monkeys in the zoo. I don't care. I don't care.
Forget it. It's a dead issue.
Yeah, I know it. Thanks, man, for your contribution.
You too, brother.
Let's go to Newport News before we wind the show down. Newport News.
Hello, gentlemen. I swear to you, this is the interesting time we live in. Let me say this to you in a strange way, and I'm going to keep it short. Everything that's going on here, like even the gentleman just talking about ADOS, I think how he was using that term is really talking about African descendants of slavery. But the interesting thing is that's been trademarked by the leaders of the group. And I remember having an encounter with you, Brother Elliot, when we were talking about them. And I said to you, I'm a little too old to speak for them, you know, and I think you might have thought I was saying it as a personal thing. But the interesting thing now is, after all the people they have lined up and come after, they finally came for me. But see, right and truth need no defense. It stands on its own bare naked. So people have inboxing me telling me what's wrong. And you know what I tell them? Stop thinking you know what's going on. Back up, look at the whole forest and see what you may have missed. So with some interesting stuff going on, I think when you catch up on it, you might want to have me come on and talk to you a little bit, because I've been getting calls from national magazines, and I tell them I don't spoon feed people, but I told people in public. I use social media as a public diary. So the people that come at me, I send back the same messages that I wrote down to remember when they stepped out of line and called me an old fool. This thing is getting better. I love that you had the sister on to use that information. Guess what I did throughout the program? When she first started into what I told you I ran into in Cobra in 1989 because of a back injury. So when I told people that they didn't know the history, a few of these so-called leaders told me they never heard of them. And you know what my response was? That's what's wrong with most people. They think that they know it all. Just because you never heard of it doesn't mean it never existed. Much love, my brothers. And I'm like the sister said, I see it growing. people that are in the space. But like you said, the true leaders in all of this, whether you talk about Garvey or whoever you hold elite, a true leader uses the pronouns we, us, and our. I studied Martin Luther King my junior and senior year in high school, but I also did Malcolm and Garvey and all of them. Even Callie House, if you look at any writings from them, if they mention themselves, it's to talk about as it exemplified throughout the collective. Yes. But when you hear them exalting themselves with I, me, and mine, believe they don't have your interest in mind. Peace, my brother.
Thank you for your contribution. Richard, interesting dialogue. The guest was interesting. It's always interesting with the guest, but when we transition to open form, it's always interesting. I love it. And believe me, you know, it might seem I get a little hype, but it's all in love. Because it's a struggle here, and we got to, if it's a cycle of ignorance on my part, or even on the guest part, or the caller's part, or people that don't even call, that listen, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to break a cycle of ignorance to get our people to study more, to find out the truth, and then when they find out the truth, to spread it. That's what it's all about to me.
Yes, it is. And we're doing the best we can.
Yes, I will. Listen, before we leave today, I just want to give out the lineup on Time for An Awakening Media. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting dialogue and conversation on Brother Oshi's program. That's African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. That's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 6 to 8. Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's from 6 to 8 on Time for An Awakening Media. From 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central, with hosts Dr. Maria Kamban and Sister Nataki Kamban, and from 9 to 10, every first and third Monday, Conversation Reparations, that's in Cobra's program. On Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m., after 7, with host Shani B. On Fridays, Time for An Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for An Awakening Media. Then on Saturdays, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And then from 7 to 9 Saturday evening, the Elders of Sankofa with host Alfonso Watkins. Then on Sunday, from 7 until Time for An Awakening is back. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.
little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school. If we know all we say we know about the problem.
To save the children.